This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Colin Wilson, welcome back to Sphinx Radio.
Thank you.
Now, Colin, you were friends with Robert Graves, the famous novelist and poet and literary critic. Could you tell us a bit about your relationship with him?
Yes. I got to know Graves because I was asked if I would write a book called The Occult.
It was just before I went out to Mallorca.
He had a house out there, lived there for the last 40 or 50 years of his life. So I looked forward to getting to know Graves because I'd read various things of his and it struck me as very important. For example, The White Goddess. Well, when I went to Mallorca, I heard a great deal about Graves, and finally a book of mine came in the post, which had just been published. I can't remember which it was now, but anyway, I took a copy over to Graves' house, and I met his wife, who was just leaving the house on her way to do some shopping, and I gave her the book, which I signed, and she said, would I like to come over for tea that afternoon? So I said, okay, thanks. And so I went over at about 4 o'clock that afternoon and met Graves, a very tall man, rather gaunt looking, very upper class kind of English accent, and a rather strange, slightly distracted manner. Anyway, we seemed to get on quite well. Graves said, do I want to look around the garden, because he had quite a large garden. And while we were in the garden, I said, I'd written about T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. I said, could I ask him about Lawrence? Immediately he clammed up. He obviously just did not want to talk about Lawrence. And anyway, apart from that, we got on fairly well. I had some tea there. But I had the feeling with him that he wasn't really being open with me. But, you know, he was in some strange way almost suspicious of me. Anyway, we were asked to go over there for supper, that is my wife and I, and we did. Once again, we got on quite well, but you know, there was still this same feeling of almost a kind of barrier between us. Well, but I knew that Graves went for a walk every day down to the beach, which was quite a long way, about 2 miles, and it was all downhill, because villages were built inland in Mallorca, because they used to have a lot of Mediterranean pirates, and so they kept it well away from the shore. Anyway, I walked with I met Graves on the way down to the sea, and when we got there, I had taken my swimming outfit, and Graves then said to me, did I want to dive in, and pointed to a rock that was fairly high, you know, maybe 6-8 feet to the top. So a little nervously I said, yes, okay, but how do we get up there? And he said, I'll show you. And what he began to do was to climb this rock very, very carefully, and telling me to do exactly the same thing that he did. you say, look, put your left hand here and your left foot there. Now, pull with your left hand and shift your right foot over to that place there, and so on. And very carefully showed me how to climb this this rock. But anyway, so we got to the top of it, and Robert then dived off the rock into the sea. I jumped off the rock because I'm not very good at diving from any kind of height. I tend to do belly smackers. Anyway, so we then went and sat down on the beach, got dry, and talked a little. And I told him about this book I was writing. I'd already told him about it. I asked him, did he have any advice for me? He said, yes, don't. And I said, well, I can't really give it up. I've got to do it. But anyway, we talked on about various things. I got the feeling that he suddenly began to like me a lot more. And then the next day, once again, I walked down to the beach. But I walked down a little later than the day before. I met Robert coming up from the beach. No, actually, I went down to the beach before Robert. And when I was on my way home, I met Robert, who said, did you climb the rock? So I said, yes. And he said, quite suddenly, this seemed to make quite a difference. And actually, I had climbed the rock exactly as Robert has shown me. It would have been very difficult to get up it without doing it in exactly the same way. He called it the transit, this way up the rock. And I noticed that from then on, quite suddenly, Robert seemed to like me, and suddenly we were getting on together very well indeed. I'm sure that if I'd asked him about T. Lawrence then, he would have been much more forthcoming. But anyway, I got to know him sort of fairly well, and I noticed one thing about him that struck me very strongly. He obviously found women very attractive, and I don't mean that in any sort of sexual sense. I think probably there was a sexual sense there. For example, there was a very pretty American girl in my class. That is the class of which I was the teacher, because I was there to teach at a school. And she was the daughter of an American who'd lived there in Mallorca. And Robert was obviously quite fond of her. But as I got to know Robert better, I realized that it wasn't just, you know, attraction to a very pretty girl. In some way, Robert was obsessed by women themselves. There was obviously something about women that struck him as almost magical. And he says in one of his poems about his tendency to overvalue women at the expense of men, which is something that I got to feel fairly strongly about with him. Well, we got to know him fairly well, and then I came upon, I'd already knew his book, The White Goddess, which I found incredibly difficult and incomprehensible. I don't know whether you know The White Goddess.
Oh yeah, very, very hard book to work through.
Yes, it is. Well, years before, this had been recommended to me by an artist who said that it was a terribly important book, and I had got it from the library, but I couldn't understand the damn thing. And it just gave me a headache. But then, just before I began working on the occult, I was very lucky. In a I came across a book by Roberts, which was simply a lot of his sort of essays and fragmentary pieces, which contained an the book itself was called Five Pens in Hand, and he meant, you know, five completely different ways that he had of writing, five different approaches to writing. And this, fortunately, had an essay on the White Goddess. So, I read this essay very carefully, and it was absolutely perfect for my book, because he explains in words of one syllable what the White Goddess is all about. And I must say, and I was deeply grateful to them to discover this. And I don't know whether you know about the White Goddess and the way that he came to write it, but what he says, let me just try and find this in my copy of the occult. Graves says in this, my enlightenment began one morning while I was rereading Lady Charlotte Guest's translation of the Mabinogion, a book of ancient Welsh legends. I came across a hitherto despised ancient Welsh legend, a hitherto despised minstrel called The Song of Taliesin. I guess minstrel must be a name for a poem. I suddenly knew, don't ask me how, that the lines of the poem, which had always been dismissed as deliberate nonsense, formed a series of early medieval riddles, and that I knew the answer to all of them. Although I was neither a Welsh scholar nor a medievalist, and although many of the lines had been deliberately transposed by the author or his successors for security reasons. And then, little by little, as Graves went on reading Lady Charlotte Guest, he began to feel that he had come into possession of a whole, a kind of armory of secrets. He says, and then, since there has never been any lunatic streak in my family, I could not believe I was going crazy. More likely, I was being inspired. So, I decided to check up on the subject with the help of a shelf full of learned books on Celtic literature, which I found in my father's library. And to cut a long story short, the answer to my riddle, namely, the letter names of the ancient Druidic alphabet, fitted the not-so-nonsensical Song of Taliesin with almost frightening exactitude. And the Battle of the Trees, which was the name of a part of it, proved to be a not-so-nonsensical way of describing a struggle between the priestesses of Celtic Britain for the control of national learning. You see, I found out that the word trees means learning in all Celtic languages. And since the alphabet is the basis of all learning, and since, as I remembered from Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, the Druidic alphabet was a jealously guarded secret in Norland Britain. Indeed, its 18-letter names were not divulged for nearly 1,000 years. Well, the possession of this secret must have been something worth struggling about. Anyway, it was through the study of this strange tree alphabet and so on that Graves gradually came to understand that what he was dealing with was an ancient Druidic religion which preceded Christianity. And what he came to understand was that this religion was basically a religion of the moon goddess, the goddess he called the White Goddess, and that the White Goddess was, in a way, the goddess of all systems to replace this ancient knowledge of the moon. Now, as I was reading all this, it suddenly struck me that Graves had given me a whole armory of understanding for the book I wanted to write. In fact, in a way, he provided me with a basic skeleton of the book. This was what it was going to be about. I could see instantly that I'd got a book which basically was about an ancient knowledge system which was as interesting and as complex as our modern knowledge, and yet completely different in certain basic ways. So I got completely fascinated by the whole thing. The other person who seemed to me to understand it very well was Gurdjieff's disciple, P.D. Uspensky. Mm. Uspensky also had this same strange ability, and he definitely achieved it to some extent by drugging himself. He doesn't say which drugs he used, although you suspect from his description in a book called A New Model of the Universe that he may well have used nitrous oxide. That is the gas the dentists used to use for putting people to sleep. And he says the same thing as Graves, that everything seemed to, in a way, turn itself into its opposite when you were in this state of knowledge. You know, black seemed to be white and white black. Everything seemed to be completely absurd and paradoxical. Anyway, I once asked Robert whether he himself had ever had any mystical experience. And he said, have a look at my story, The Abominable Mr. Gunn. So anyway, I went and found The Abominable Mr. Gunn in a book of his short stories, and found it a very curious work. What he describes is how one day, sitting behind the school cricket pavilion, and just sitting there on a roller, watching them play cricket, he was struck by a curious, what he calls a celestial illumination. And this is what he says. It occurred to me that I knew everything. I remember letting my mind range rapidly over all its familiar subjects of knowledge, only to find that this was in no way a foolish fancy. I did know everything. Or, to be plain, though conscious of having come less than a third of the way along the path of formal education, being weak in mathematics, shaky in Greek grammar, and hazy about English history, I nevertheless held the key of the truth in my hand and could use it to open the lock of any door. Mine was no religious or philosophical theory, but a simple method of looking sideways at disorderly facts so as to make perfect sense of them. Then Groves goes on to explain that he tried out his insight on what he calls various obstinate locks, and it all clicked and they all opened smoothly. The insight was still intact when he woke up the next morning, and still he found, you know, he got this strange knowledge which had come to him quite suddenly sitting there behind the school pavilion. And then after a morning's lessons, he decided it would be sensible to try and put all this down on paper in an exercise book. And so this is what he did, and this was a great mistake, fatal mistake, because he began to write, and then began to feel, no, that's not quite right, and began crossing out. And before he knew where he was, he'd made such a mess of it that what he was trying to say had disappeared completely. And unfortunately, it never came back again. Now, what he did say, though, was that routine processes of thought and leapt straight from problems to answer. Now, he went on to talk about a fellow pupil at school called Smillie, F.F. Smillie, who'd apparently developed this power of a calculating prodigy. The master in charge of the class, Mr. Gunn, you remember the story was called The Abominable Mr. Gunn, had set them a complicated mathematical problem. Smillie simply wrote down the solution and then sat gazing at it out of the window. Asked how he did it, and without the written calculation, Smillie replied, "It just came to me. I looked at the problem and saw the answer immediately." Mr. Gunn said, "You mean you looked up the answer in the back of the book?" Smillie replied, "No, this was untrue. And anyway, the answer in the back of the book was partly wrong. Got some of the figures the wrong way around." Mr. Gunn was so angry, he sent him to the headmaster to be caned. And then after that, whenever Smillie showed this same strange ability, knowing the answer to problems and writing down the answer, Mr. Gunn used to treat him very, very badly and forced him to do them at great length. And gradually, Smillie's ability to do this spontaneously disappeared completely. Now, that, Graves says, is an example of this strange ability of the mind to leap straight up to the conclusion. And this is what I saw is, in a way, the solution to my book. Robert was saying was that there are obviously two kinds of knowledge. One is this kind of intellectual knowledge, which is precise and demands step by step. Yet there's one kind of knowledge which is step by step, rather like trying to find your way across a stream by standing on a series of rocks. And one way, which is like leaping straight across the stream in a single go. And it's this set of knowledge that Graves was talking about, and that I saw was the answer to the whole notion of, you know, the so-called occult. For example, he once said to me that poems were written in the fifth dimension. And like, fifth dimension, what do you mean? Well, he either couldn't or wouldn't explain. But I brooded on this. I thought, what could he mean, poems are written in the fifth dimension? And I thought, well, normally when we speak of the three dimensions of a thing, we mean, you know, its length and breadth and height and so on. And obviously, in our ordinary world, things have three dimensions. But then, of course, there's the fourth dimension, as Einstein realized, the dimension of time. So that if, for example, you agree to meet someone at a certain time and place, you give them the time, otherwise you probably go there at different times. Now, it suddenly struck me, these are the four ordinary coordinates, everything that happens. But then, if you think of it, when you're writing in a state of intensity and inspiration, what happens is that your mind once again begins to leap, take these leaps, intuitive leaps, and you suddenly know things that you normally would not know. The mind has somehow been pushed into a new kind of knowledge, which we surely possess naturally. All of us possess it all the time. In fact, when I talked to Graves about this other kind of knowledge, he said, well, occult knowledge is not as rare as you think. In fact, it's possessed, you know, by an enormous number of people. He said, in fact, it's possessed by one person in every 20. Now, that interested me very much, because I had also made the discovery that there is, in any group of animals, what has been called by biologists the dominant 5%. That is, you know, 5 in every 100. And this dominant 5%, or 1 in 20, are the people who possess, you know, some extraordinary ability. They're the people who, you know, in war situations, for example, are the heroes and so on. I was fascinated by the fact that my dominant 5% were turning out also to be, well, I suppose, the poets, the people who had the inspiration. And then I thought, well, that's not so strange. If you're thinking about ancient people, you know, several thousand years ago, about hunters and that kind of thing, the people in charge of the tribe were, in fact, probably the witch doctors, the so-called magicians and so on, and that these would, in fact, be the naturally dominant people. And it was understanding this, the way that dominance works, that made me understand the way that, in fact, people can develop all kinds of odd abilities that they don't normally understand they have. So when Graves said to me that far more people have these capacities than we realize, he said something that for me was terribly important. I've always believed deeply people have this strange ability to increase their intuitive powers, and yet at the same time to increase their intellectual powers. This has been, you know, part of my lifelong obsession. And what interested me so much about Robert Graves is that he handed me the whole solution, as it were, on a plate. And that, in a sense, Robert himself had written the right white goddess for me, or showed me what had to be written. Robert had, in fact, given me the whole outline of another knowledge system. That's what interested me so much. See, ever since I've been a teenager, I've been fascinated by science, specifically by physics and quantum theory and that kind of thing. What he made me understand was that there's a completely different kind of knowledge, a different approach to knowledge. And this is what I wrote about in the occult. But as I said, the only other person who really seemed to understand that was Uspensky, Gurdjieff's disciple. He also said that there comes a kind of point where, you know, suddenly there's an element of absurdity about the whole thing. It's actually worth reading the whole of the chapter in which he talks about this in his book. Let me think. It's A New Model of the Universe. And that will tell you more about the occult and the paranormal than I possibly could.
Just to sum up, Robert Graves believed that this intuitive ability was feminine. Is that correct?
Well, that was the reason he was so fascinated by women, that he thought that this is a knowledge system that always starts with women rather than with men. And, yes, and he thought that it's a feminine thing. He called this the book The White Goddess because he thought that, in fact, it was, if you like, a feminine knowledge system. You see, he says that we tend to have forgotten this in the modern world, that we think simply in terms of knowledge, you know, meaning some kind of bright, sun-like thing. But in point of fact, it's half of it strange and obscure and intuitive. But what he's really saying is more important than just that. He's saying that if we really want to understand something, we have to get into a different kind of knowledge. Now, we all know this, for example, in things to do with love and emotion and with sex. We all notice that there are certain times when we understand something much more deeply than at other times. And as I said, talking about is the way in which the first knowledge system, as it were, that formed among human tribes was a basically female knowledge system, and that everything else was based on this. And it was only later, when men became increasingly dominant and tended to push out this original female knowledge system, that we began to get this kind of mess that we've got in the modern world, and which, you know, means that we're capable of all kinds of neurosis and stupidity, and, you know, probably half the things that are wrong with our modern civilization.
Very good, Colin Wilson. I'd like to thank you for being on Sphinx Radio. That was an excellent summation of Robert Graves' idea. And will you come back sometime? Maybe we can talk about Gurdjieff or something.
Okay.
Very good. Okay.